Well, we were studying last week in 2 Samuel 13 about Amnon and his lust for his sister and how he ended up abusing her. And we were down to about verse 12. We read 12 and 13, and there are four things in this that describe for us the situation pretty clearly about what sin is, what sin does, and what it's against. First of all, sin, you'll notice in verse 12, such a thing should not be done in Israel. Sin is against a nation. You think of any passages that say something like that? You ever heard of any passages that say that sin has some effect on the nation we live in? Or do you know any examples?
2 Chronicles 7:14.
And that's one of the major passages in the Old Testament talking about what they need to do to stay right. Can you quote it?
No, okay. I'd get it wrong.
Could you hold it for just a second and be ready to read it? That would be excellent. Somebody else said something. Joy?
When Achan took the spoils from
Ai. It wasn't just Achan's recompense there, was it? Others, almost 40 men lost their lives because of his greed. Greg?
Yeah, we mentioned this on Sunday morning, Hosea 4:6.
Hosea 4:6.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Even if you do it in ignorance, they're destroyed for lack of knowledge. Yes. Proverbs 14:34. Yeah, very good. And okay, are you ready?
Okay. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land.
Isn't that a powerful passage? And they all are. And I remember hearing someone say that his father was around during World War I and World War II. And after World War I, he noticed the morality in, say, France, as an illustration. They were the only ones guilty of this. The morality just sank to a very low level. And as we've said before, World War I killed a lot of people's faith in God. It was a horrendous thing. And it ended up causing people to say, if there is a God, he wouldn't have let this happen, so there must not be a God. And therefore, their morals just went to the cesspool. And he said he was fearful that period between World War I and World War II, just a period of a little over 20 years, that it would end up causing another war. And sure enough, it did. And he saw their morals just continually get worse and worse and worse. Great Britain shared in that, and Italy and various others. You can see all throughout the Bible, take Sodom. They reach a point of no return where God says, now I'm going to have to deal with you. Babylon in Daniel 5, you're weighing the balances and found wanting. There's not enough moral worth in this nation to keep it able to balance the scales any longer. I can't put up with it any longer. You're gone. And that night they were. So, verse 12 shows sin is a terrible thing for a nation. The second thing, sin is terrible for the victims of it. If someone is a victim of sin, she calls it a disgraceful thing. Do not do this disgraceful thing. Where could I take my shame? It's a harmful thing to someone else. I think of Genesis 34, when Shechem, the son of Hamor, saw Dinah and had a similar view toward her that Amnon had toward his half-sister. And the result of that was he took her and violated her. And strangely enough, unlike Amnon, then it says he loved her. And he loved her so much he would have done anything to keep her. And that's when Simeon and Levi went in and wiped them out in their state of incapacity. But here's Amnon, quite the opposite. He loves her until he violates her, then he can't stand her and he throws her out. Sin, in many ways, is a terrible thing against other people. She says it's something about my reproach. It's going to be my reproach. I will be looked down upon. I'll probably never get married, which was typically what would happen in an occasion like this. He doesn't care. And then she says, as far as you're concerned, look at your reputation. You'll be a fool. So it's a lose-lose situation for the both of us. Obviously, she didn't believe in situation ethics. Amnon did. The third thing, you'll notice, she says, and as for you, verse 13, you would be like one of the fools in Israel. You'll be like one of the fools in Israel. You think about verse 28. When Absalom has his sheep shearing, that was a time of great festivity, and he wants David to come, probably knowing David wouldn't come, but he gets Amnon, the oldest son, the royal heir apparent, to come. And he instructs his men, now when he's married with wine, strike Amnon, then kill him. Verse 28. I'm the one who commanded you, so be courageous and valiant. Nothing will happen to you. It'll be all up to me. I'll take the full brunt of this. I wonder if Amnon had known that in 2 years, this would happen to him, if he would have managed to curb his lust. I can't help but believe he could. And then the fourth thing, sin is against God. The last thing God wants is for there to be fools in Israel. Now, Psalm 14:1, the passage that we all learned many years ago, and it's repeated a little later. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Now, the fool in biblical parlance, and the way the Bible uses this term, is not so much of a person who's an empty head. Today you hear the word fool and you think, someone who doesn't know anything, he's a fool. He don't know what side of the road to drive on. And they insult a person with that term. People need to be very careful how they use that term, by the way. But here, this is referring to a moral lack, not a mental lack. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Then he goes on to describe, well, they don't know how to cross the street. They don't know how to cook bread. They don't know how to go to the store. It's not that they don't have a mind. In fact, intelligent-wise, look at the book of Proverbs. They may be some of the sharpest knives in the drawer about worldly ways. Chapter 1 starts with these young boys who are trying to get another young boy to help them go rob these people, and we'll have this one person. We will make a killing, quite literally. But it's describing their character. Verse 1, they are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There's none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand who seek God. They've all turned aside. They've altogether become corrupt. There's none who does good, no, not one. He calls them the workers of iniquity in verse 4. And on you can go with this. Proverbs is filled with that too. The word fool here, she says, you'll be as one of the fools in Israel. Who else in this book, in the previous writing of Samuel, was called a fool? Nabal. And you can include Saul, but it's Nabal's name. Fool's my name and folly's my game. And he ended up in a very sad state. Fools mock at sin, but among the upright there's favor. Proverbs 14:9. Notice the contrast. It's fools mock at sin, but those who have a nice brain and good memory, no. Fools mock at sin, but among the upright, there's the contrast. A fool is someone who is not upright. Proverbs 14, verse 9. So those four areas, the nation, the victim, the perpetrator, even God Himself. God demands and He expects better than for His people to be fools. And that's what she's trying to say to this man who can't see past his passion for her. Now, in the latter part of verse 13, she says, now therefore please speak to the king for me, for he will not withhold me from you. What is she saying there? Talk to the king and he'll let you have me as a wife. We can do this lawfully and honorably. Right? Now, I thought Leviticus 18:9 says you're not to marry someone who's your sister. But then the counter to it, according to some, and they may have been loose enough to think this way, who was Abraham's wife? Half-sister, and that was his half-sister here. So they could argue both ways, most likely. But I don't really think that's what's going on. What is another possibility? Why is she saying this? After all, Greg, you've got a smile, you know.
Buying time.
Go talk to my daddy. What's she going to do in the meantime? She's headed to Canada. She's getting out of there. I suspect that's what's going on. I don't know. But in any event, in verse 14, however, it didn't work. He would not heed her voice. And being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. So there's the abuse. Passion is deaf and blind and selfish and heartless and devoid of pity. I think of the men in Sodom in Genesis 19 who absolutely tried their best to destroy the men in Lot's house who were angels instead, and they got their comeuppance. But that showed the Lord, they're as bad as we've heard. If they would do this, there's no stopping them. And even after they're struck blind, they're still trying to find their way in. And then I think about Judges 19 to 21. You're probably already thinking of that. You're turning that problem. And in that passage, the men are the same thing and how they abused the woman all night long when they couldn't get the men. It is a thing that is devoid of pity. It's all about me. It's all about satisfying myself and no one else, no matter what cost it brings to someone else. So you will see in verse 15, he would not heed her voice, but being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, arise, be gone. Verse 15 comes as sort of a shock, doesn't it? You don't expect verse 15 in all of its forcefulness to come this closely after doing what he's done and talking the way he's talked. He hated her exceedingly with greater hatred than he had so-called loved her. And then he tells her to get out of here. And then in verse 16, she said to him, no, indeed. This evil of sending me away is worse than the other that you did to me. But he would not listen to her. He accepts no responsibility toward her. He accepts no responsibility for what he's done. He doesn't care what it does to her for her future and her life. It's done. So he has taken from her a prized possession. She is shamed by her own half-brother. She's as good as dead in her mind because probably will not be able to marry. And it's going to imply that she is the instigator because he sends her away as though she is to blame for all this. He's not being sent away. He sends her away as though it's all her fault. And she had nothing to do with it. So then in verse 16, but he would not listen to her. And in 17, he called his servant who attended him and said, here, put this, and the woman is supplied, put this out away from me and bolt the door behind her. Now that's contempt and it's callousness. It's an insult that's added to the injury. In verse 18, now she had on a robe of many colors, literally a long-sleeved garment. And it says, for the king's virgin daughters wore such apparel. And his servant put her out and bolted the door behind her. Don't let her back in here. She's bad news. She's trouble. She causes all kinds of heartache. Then Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her robe of many colors that was on her and laid her hand on her head and went away crying bitterly. So she's been abandoned. And in verse 20, Absalom, her brother, said to her, and here's the first time we see Absalom get involved in what is going to be the rest of his story that goes on in this context. Absalom, her brother, said to her, has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this thing to heart. So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. Why can you not believe Absalom when he says, don't take this to heart? He's just trying to console her. How do you know that? Because he certainly takes it to heart. He's going to kill this man if his father doesn't. He takes it to heart. It's as bad as it can be, regardless of their relationship, being a brother and sister halfway. Now, Absalom, her brother, finds her. This is the first seed that we can be certain about of the rebellion of Absalom that's coming. This is the first seed, the first step in that direction. His sister's been violated. Now the question begs an answer. What is the king going to do about this? That's the answer, right? That's the answer he wants. What's the king going to do about this? That should have taken him out of this picture and let the king render the vengeance that was due her. Therefore, it says, so Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. What cruelty to another person. So verse 21, when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. Now, what else? He expected to say, and he got up and he went over to Amnon's house and... But no. There's total silence about anything more than just his being upset that this occurred. He's been used. He's the one who sent her over at the behest of the half-brother, and yet there's no action. So in verse 22, Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon neither good nor bad. Two things I see in that. Number one, he is stewing. You can see a person whose anger is boiling, and it continues to boil over as he waits for something to be done. And second, he sees that nobody else is going to do a single thing about this atrocity. It's his sister, his full sister, and nobody even cares. And so his anger grows. David was very angry. I'll guarantee you Absalom was. It says he didn't speak to Amnon one way or another. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. This is some royal family, isn't it? Some royal family. Boy, they are being torn apart. Oh, that's what chapter 12 predicted, isn't it? This is the seed that's going to continue to grow and produce bitter fruit. Now, David was very angry but did nothing. What other fathers have we seen that would illustrate?
Eli.
That's the first one I think of. Eli did nothing. Now, what's another one? And this is a stranger of the two. Samuel, who could learn off Eli's dime and did not do so. And now David comes along. He knows the history of both of those. He knew Samuel personally. He would have known Samuel's sons, I'm quite sure, or known of them. He doesn't do anything. So, in verse 23, it came to pass after two full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. So Absalom invited all the king's sons. That looks a little bit fishy. If you know what's in his mind, and he says, I want all the king's sons to come, that looks a little fishy. David, your hand up. Yes.
And yet he didn't learn how to do that.
Yes. He didn't take that lesson. Tim?
Like that, you paused here. I had a couple of thoughts. While verse 15 is kind of surprising, when you think about it from a larger picture of just sin in general, his planning and execution of that was probably pretty fun, his mind. But the reward of it was not there. And all sin is really that way. It's fun, like, to think about it or engaging in it again, according to each.
It's what they call an apple of Sodom. You touch it and it just goes poof, it's not there. That's right.
And the other one was, it seems a little odd that Absalom's first guess is 100% on the money.
I know.
Why is that? Does Amnon have this reputation?
It makes you wonder.
It does.
Yeah, that's a very good observation. I've wondered, I don't know an answer, but I suspect there was a reason for his suspecting Amnon instead of somebody else.
Okay. Yes? We couldn't hear that over.
I was just surprised that Absalom's first guess at what has happened is 100% on the money. I mean, that wouldn't have been my first guess. It was his. I wonder if there wasn't something.
He probably knew him pretty good.
Yeah.
That seems to be the case. Yeah.
I figured out she had torn a garment that was supposed to be a representative of her virginity.
Yes.
So that's torn. You put a couple things together.
And he may even have known that she had gone to his house to serve him because he's sick. Who knows? But if they eat regularly with the king, word might have gotten around. But I lean more toward the reputation. But I can't answer it one way or another. Yes, sir.
I think that too, as far as probably Absalom knew that she was going to go over to him. But you know, thinking too, another, like Tim saying, multiple comment here. You know, between verse 20 and 23. There's a lot of history that occurred that's not recorded for us.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It tells us in verse 21 that King David heard all the things. So you kind of wonder who told him. You know, and perhaps, Absalom, when he was saying that, basically he said, don't take it to heart, Tamar. Maybe he was saying, don't worry, I'll take care of this. Maybe I'm just speculating here, but maybe he thought that David would take care of it. And turns out he didn't, and that's what he was kind of stupid about.
Well,
it did take 2 years later, just when something wrong occurred.
The law is pretty clear, Leviticus 18 to 20, what the duty is on David's part. The fact that David does nothing. It would be hard for me to imagine that Absalom doesn't go to David and tell him what's been done. He would be the most logical one to tell him what's been done. She's not in any shape to go and say anything. And if he sees that David's very angry, because it tells us he heard, he's very angry, regardless of who told him, and yet the days go by, the weeks go by, the months go by, 2 years pass, and nothing's happened. And in the meantime, like battery acid on Absalom, he is boiling. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And so it finally culminates in what we see in this chapter. So all those are excellent observations. But some of it, the specifics, I just don't know more than that. Dave.
Thinking about that, this seems to be, and this maybe could be Absalom's anchor message or anchor point. When, later when he's telling the people, you have nobody to go to.
Yes.
To hear your case, this could be his very, very much his anchor point of, this happened, he didn't do anything.
Very much what I think chapter 15 is saying, the first six verses, is look, I'll tell you how they respond. They won't do anything. It happened with my own sister. I could just hear him say it. And so you anticipate what I was going to say. That doesn't put you in bad light. It just means you have something to work on here. Any other comments? Okay. Verse 23 then, 2 years go by. And you know, I've known of people who've held grudges for 30 or 40 years. Not that I knew them all that time, but I learned about it. Here's a guy who's holding a grudge, obviously. He has sheep shears. And he invites all the king's sons. And so he comes to the king and he said, kindly note, your servant has sheep shears. Now this is a time for great rejoicing, a great jubilee. It's time for everybody to be happy. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant. So it looks like he's outwardly, he's over the shock, he's over the pain and the hurt, and he's getting back to being a king's son and having all his family around him again and really having a really good time. Let the king and his servants go with your servant. He's disguising his real intentions, of course. So the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be a burden to you. Then he urged him, but he would not go, and he blessed him. So Absalom says, if not, please let my brother Amnon go with us. The king said to him, why should he go with you? And at this point, if I were David, what am I thinking? I don't want him within 3 miles of you. How far can you sling a stone, keep him 10 times that from you? No. This seems rather naive of David, but let him go. The only reason I can think of that would seem legitimate to me is that Amnon is saying, look, he's the oldest son. He's the representative of the king. He's the one who will be king next. So let him go. And if you can't come, let the next best thing get here. Which to David may have appeared very magnanimous. He's gotten all over this and he wants him to come to his party. I would have thought he would shun him. He's not shunning him. All is well again. Which means David may have forgotten what Nathan had warned him was going to happen. But why should he go with you? Then in 27, Absalom urged him. It doesn't say that he gave a reason necessarily, he just urged him. So he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So I think David is rather gullible and naive at this point. But in verse 28, now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, watch now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? Two things, I believe, are going on in verse 28. Check me on this. Number one, there's revenge. That part, I think, is obvious. Nobody would question that. The second thing that I suspect that is going on is that Absalom is running for king. If he's number three in the line, but Kileab apparently is dead, number two is dead, if Amnon's taken out of the way, Absalom is number one. He's in first line to be king. David is not acting like a king. Israel needs a king who is a real king. Thus the first few verses of chapter 15. If I were your king, I'd hear your case. I would act on your behalf. I would punish people who do bad things. Boy, would I punish them. I've shown you I can. You ever heard of Amnon? Look what I did. So that seems to me to be what he's doing here. But in any event, I think the chief of these is the revenge. Now, the irony is this. When Amnon's heart is merry with wine, this young man is just living it up. The life of Riley, got it made. Strike him. Just kind of like David instructed Joab to kill Uriah. David doesn't actually take the sword or the spear, but he has Joab to put in a place where someone else would. Absalom doesn't actually do it, but he has his men do it, so he's behind it just as David was with Uriah. Then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? There'll be a new crown prince. I will protect you. So, in verse 29, the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose and each one got on his mule and fled. There's a whole bunch in verse 29 we just can't see. It doesn't describe the absolute panic, the screaming, the tears, whatever else was in those boys' hearts as they're fleeing. You can imagine they're scared out of their minds. Probably thinking he's going to kill all of them. But he was after only one. So, in verse 30, it came to pass while they were on the way that news came to David saying, Absalom has killed all the king's sons and not one of them's left. It kind of sounds like the modern media, doesn't it? If you'd exaggerate a little more, it probably would be just like it. So the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the ground, and all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Now verse 31 is very illuminating. First of all, I would say, by a conservative guess, this news probably aged David 40 years. If he's in his upper years already, he's probably feeling 100 right now, thinking he's lost all of his sons. Second thing I see here, it says the king arose and did this. He's a king, but he's helpless. He's a king, but he can't protect his children wherever they go. He can't protect his daughters wherever they are. He can act in a proper way when someone does something wrong, if he will. But he's the king, and yet he's helpless. Third, it shows the consequences of sin continue. The Pandora's box has been opened, and David's the one who raised the lid. And now he's seeing what Nathan said coming true. He can imagine, after what Nathan said, that maybe he's lost every son he had, which is a horrible thing to contemplate. And then David, of course, recognizes, and this is the worst part of it all, who's to blame for all this? He is. He's the real cause. If he hadn't been himself guilty of such sin, he would have had a better backbone to take care of his children when they were in sin, I would imagine. Well, in verse 32, then Jonadab, the son of Shimeah. Now, who is Jonadab? Where have we seen him before? He's a wily, clever young man. Who is he? He started the whole thing. Whether he meant for it to go this far or not, I don't know. But Jonadab, he's a crafty, clever kind of guy. Not always in a good way. David's brother's son. He answered and said, let not my lord suppose they've killed all the young men, the king's sons, for only Amnon is dead. I doubt that Absalom told him he was going to do this. But I think he was shrewd enough to realize it's only one man he's after. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he forced his sister Tamar. The murder that would avenge the rape is what he knew was going to occur. He knew Absalom wouldn't let this pass. Now therefore let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. I think of Proverbs 5 and 6 and 7 where it talks about someone who violates a man's wife, for example. And in doing so, it warns that when this occurs, you're not going to get off scot-free. Proverbs 5, 6, and 7. In chapter 6, it tells us that people, in verse 30, don't despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself. You may put him in jail, but you won't despise him. You say, I can't understand why he's going to do something to feed himself. When he's found, though, he must restore sevenfold. But in verse 32, whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Wounds and dishonor he will get. His reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is a husband's fury. She has someone who's going to avenge her. Jealousy is his fury. Therefore, he will not spare the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense. You could promise him your house, your land, everything you have, and he won't take any of it. He wants one thing, and that's your life. Nor will he be appeased though you give many gifts. He's going to kill you. So, is your hand up, David? Okay. I don't know.
It makes me wonder if there were other people that knew this was going to happen.
If so, that would be someone like Jonadab. But I don't know. I've wondered too, but I have no answer. Does anybody have an answer for that? Honor?
Would they not have bunches and bunches of servants and sheep shearers running around?
They could. It would take a while to do that. There is some miles from where they are, but that would happen. And maybe the way it's written, it took a little longer than it appears in the text. Maybe that's the answer to it. Well, at any rate, in verse 33, now therefore let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. Oh, I feel so much better, right? Oh, I just lost Amnon. That's okay. And so David is still seeing the consequences of sin, and the fact that he does nothing makes it all worse. In verse 34, now we're going to see Absalom leaving. In watching him leave, you're going to see this take place. Verse 34, then Absalom fled. That describes the flight. In verse 37, but Absalom fled. That's the same thing as said in 34. Then it adds this, and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. 38 says, so Absalom fled and went to Geshur. That's what he said in 34 and 37. But now he adds, and was there 3 years. So it tells us he fled, tells us where he went, and then it tells us how long he stayed. So there's a progression in each of these three statements. It makes very good illustration of the way they wrote. Now, Absalom fled. The young man who was keeping watch lifted his eyes and looked. And there are many people were coming from the road on the hillside behind him. Jonadab said to the king, look, the king's sons are coming. As your servant said, so is it. So this Jonadab is a worldly wise young man. So it was, as soon as he'd finished speaking, the king's sons indeed came, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly. David's wondering, when will this ever end? And he hasn't seen anything yet. Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And we're told that King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. Now, in verse 23 of this chapter, it tells us after 2 years, so after the rape had occurred, the 2 years pass, Absalom goes and he stays at Talmai for 3 more years. So this is 5 years total. In chapter 14, verse 28, it will tell us Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem after getting back from that place. So quite a few years go by here in a rather compressed period as concerning the way these things are written. Now, David goes basically to his maternal grandfather. He's the king of this region. Okay. What would a maternal grandfather say to his grandson if he comes and says, I have a half-brother who violated my sister and I killed him? What's this man going to say? He's going to say, that's what I would have done. David finds acceptance there. Or Absalom finds acceptance there. Is it possible that Absalom learns from this that the ways of God are one way, and David knew those, but I just know that didn't take care of the problem. But here's a man in the world. He knows a way that matches my way that I think is right and he thinks is right. Did that give him some kind of an appeal like you see so many times with young people today? They say, here's what the Bible says, but this professor says, and they go by the professor rather than the Bible. It could be something like that's going on here. Okay, are there any comments anybody else has on this? Stay. Oh, sure.
Oh.
Excellent point.
Give you a suggestion. Kind of lead you down a path and all of a sudden jump out and say, I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know why he did that.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
It's always up to me.
We all know Jonadab's. You're right.
Would he not be an accessory?
I think he...
In verse 33, he seems to have known that this was going to happen, or at least that was a possibility. He hasn't said anything yet.
I know. I don't favor the young man myself, but I don't know legally what you can say about it.
Verse 35 follows it up and says, "See, they're coming just as I told them."
Yeah, just so I know. He's got to let people know that he knows so they can praise him for his wisdom. Then, Matt, your hand's up.
Who do you think David is mourning for in 37? Is he mourning for Absalom?
It's ambiguous. It's ambiguous.
He's more upset to me about Absalom, considering how foolish he is about it. Later on, you wonder that it seems that they love him and kind of had it coming, but I mean, it's worked out this way with Absalom.
I debated myself. And came out neutral? I don't know. It's absolutely ambiguous. I don't know. Then Tim had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this has several examples of sin not dealt quickly with.
Yes, yes. And the consequences of not dealing with it in a proper, timely manner. Yes. And then Steve, your hand was up. I thought, go ahead. I'm not rushing. Obviously. I can see it. Also, what adds some more grist for the mill in chapter 14, verse 1, when it says the king's heart was concerned about Absalom, the word about could also be translated against Absalom. He was concerned against him. What does that mean? I favor about, but it could be either one. Greg?
Yeah, in verse 28, I thought it was interesting that he tells the servants to be courageous and valiant. He's quite the manipulator.
Oh, yeah.
Useful idiots, I think is the term. The fact is, these are people who are going to do something very, very wrong. He's got them, kind of a rah-rah thing. Go out and do this for me.
Yeah, well-trained.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're willing to do it. Did I see another hand up? Okay. Couple of minutes. David and Amnon compare in several ways. Both of them are guilty of the sin of the lust of the eyes in 1 John 2:16. David with Bathsheba, Amnon with his half-sister. They're alike in that way. Both of them have an obsession. David's obsession so much with Bathsheba, he has to call her and have her. Amnon with his sister Tamar. Ecclesiastes 8:11, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them. That describes an obsession. It's fully set in them to do evil. And you see it in Genesis 6:5. Their hearts were only evil continually. Only evil continually. They were both helped by others. David was helped by Joab to the murder. Amnon was helped by Jonadab to the rape. There was a pretense, a deception. David had to trick Uriah to try to make it look like it was his child. Amnon had to try to trick Tamar, not only to get her to the house, but to get her into the chamber where he could grab her. Both watched their victim. David watched Tamar, watched Bathsheba as she was bathing. Amnon watched his sister as she was cooking. Both used food to deceive. David gets Uriah to eat food and try to get him drunk, in fact. David used Tamar with food to get her there so he could abuse her. Both wanted to be alone with their respective victims. It was a serious crime. David commits adultery, lying, and murder. Amnon commits rape, incest, and then rejection on top of that. It was a matter of great shame. 2 Samuel 15, verse 30 will describe the shame on David's part. Maybe the Lord is doing all this to me because he sees how bad I've been and I deserve what he's doing. Amnon is remembered for one thing and one thing only. That's what he did to his sister. We don't know anything else about Amnon, actually, besides he's been killed. And we feel that he deserved that. And then both used a servant. David has someone else to fetch her to the place to have the liaison between him Bathsheba, as well as to have the liaison between him and Joab to get him killed, to get Uriah killed. Amnon used servants not only to have her here, then to go out so that he could do the deed, and then to throw her out when he's through with her. And then the consequences. David has tragedies the rest of his life. Amnon meets with death, and it doesn't fare well for any of them. So David avoids retaliation against Saul all those years. He avoids retaliating. But David avoids also punishing someone who didn't deserve being let off the hook when he doesn't deal with Amnon as he should. Absalom is going to retaliate against Amnon and David. So there's a yours, mine, and our as the world vomits in this family at this point, and it gets worse as the time goes on. Any comments? Okay, the Lord willing, on 2 Samuel 14 next time. Thanks for your help tonight.